You're listening to a Castaway Media podcast. Find more great shows at castaway.media or find us on Facebook, facebook.com/castawaypodcasts.
Welcome to the Retro Asylum. Welcome to the Retro Asylum.
Hi guys, this is Steve, aka Press Play on Tape, and you're listening to episode 139 of the Retro Asylum, the UK's number one award-winning podcast show. So, it's been a while since I've hosted the show, and you might remember the last time I appeared on the show was the Bitmap Books special, where I chatted to Sam Dyer and Matt Wilshire about Sam's Specky Compendium book. Now, you also might remember that in that episode, Mr. Matt Wilshire announced his return to the Retro Asylum as a host. Well, just a quick few months later, and we're back. Me and Matt have been chatting for a while about doing an episode about something slightly different than games. And so we've come up with the idea of chatting about how we used to use our computers to be creative. So as Matt's decided to host again, and as he's done nearly all of the research for the show, I'm just going to hand over to him and let him tell you what it's all about. So hello, Matt.
Hello. Thank you very much. Yes, the creative stuff. And I'm glad you announced the podcast as the award-winning rather than the UK's number one retro gaming podcast, because this is not about gaming. And you might think that's bad. But you know what? When we were younger and we had our Spectrums, Commodores, Amigas, we didn't always use it for gaming. So we've decided to talk creatively. So that means we're going to talk about coding, graphics, music, what we did on our computers that didn't involve gaming. It might have ended up in a game if you were lucky enough to do that. Certainly I wasn't one of them. But this is about what are we using for other than gaming. So I think it'll be really interesting. We're not going to go too in-depth. We're not going to go back to sort of mainframes and punch cards and all that sort of really deep stuff. We're going to keep it probably with the mainstream platforms. I think that's where everybody resonates with more than going a bit deeper into stuff. But we're going to talk about a wide variety of applications that we did, we could have done, and what you can go away and research afterwards. So I hope you enjoy it. I think myself and Steve have got a genuine passion in this sort of stuff because we are more from the creative side. And I think actually the majority of hosts on this podcast had a bit of a creative side to them. I know Dean certainly did way back in the day. So it's an interesting one to cover. So they will come on to that in about sort of 10, 15 minutes. But Steve, the news.
The news. Okay, so first of all, I think we're going to have to touch on this, Matt, because every single retro gaming podcast I've been listening to now over the last couple of weeks, one by one, they have all started talking about this shambolic Coleco Chameleon console crisis that's happening at the minute. So have you been following it at all, Matt?
Yeah, I caught wind of it less than a week ago, actually, and I had to put two and two together because there was this name banded around of Mike Kennedy, and I thought, hold on a minute, that's Retro Gaming Roundup, isn't it? And then digging a bit deeper, I see that he left it and went off to form this company, and then there's this massive backlash, and he's basically the devil of the retro scene right now, isn't he?
Well, pretty much, yeah. I mean, it appears, and I'm not saying that he has, because I don't want to, you know, get libeled or anything, but it appears that he's like basically been trying to scam the retro community. And I want to say that essentially they announced this the original one, the Retro DDS, I can't remember. Retro VCS.
Yeah, something like that.
Retro
yeah.
VCS, yeah. Which was essentially he bought the rights to the Jaguar casings, the old Atari Jaguar console casings, and had struck upon this idea of making a console that was a modern console but actually used cartridges, but like the way we used to do back in the day. So you had no loading times, and you know it was like sort of back to old school gaming. And now, to me, I couldn't quite work out what the idea was, because he sort of said like that it would not be able to have any kind of, like, you couldn't patch any games, you couldn't have any downloadable content. Whatever you got as the game would be the game. And I was like, well, I love the idea of having the cartridges again, because that was a nice, you know, to just bang a game in the top and just switch it on. I still do it now with my Mega Drive and my SNES. It's just like, game is on. And I love that. It feels like an arcade game. But to say, like, we're going to lock out DLC from, you know, so that you, So that game, if that game comes out on any other platform, be it, you know, PlayStation or Steam or Xbox or anything, they're going to get patches, they're going to get DLC, they're going to get updates, and you on your super amazing Calico Chameleon aren't.
So it was going to be a modern day console initially?
Yeah, so it was going to be a modern console that you could basically develop indie games for. They had some indie game developers were going to be developing for it. But the idea was no DLC, no add-ons, no updates. It was like you get your cartridge with the game on, and that's that.
So it's a whole new platform, essentially.
So obviously, yeah. So they did some photo mock-ups of it, and I thought it looked pretty cool. It had a nice controller, although I think it looked a bit like a black version of the sort of the Wii gaming controller, you know, the one that had the sort of SNES.
Classic controller.
Yes, it looked a lot like that. And then obviously it had the Jaguar casing. But they initially brought it out and they tried to bring it on Indiegogo and it just flopped. They didn't get the funding for it. So then they were going to bring it to Kickstarter. But to bring it to Kickstarter, you've got to have a prototype, a working prototype. That's the rules. So they've been to this toy fair in America to show it off, but it was like a closed door, wasn't open to the public. And they had the prototype there with what looked like some games on it. But sort of like steely-eyed viewers who were looking at the sort of little crappy video clip that they had of it playing spotted that it had what appeared to be a SNES Junior sort of wedged into the back of it, covered up with masking tape. And then like the cartridge slot was an exact match for a SNES cartridge slot. So like they like basically got called out upon it.
So this is Miss Marple of the internet doing their worst to pick this apart.
They picked it apart and they did. They got onto it. So that was that. And then so like they sort of went away. Coleco Chameleon people went away and basically said, "Oh no, don't worry. We've got a proper prototype which we're going to announce ready for the Kickstarter." Then on their Facebook page, they bring out some photo mock-ups now of the new one with supposedly the proper hardware.
That's where I picked up the story.
This is where you're up to, yeah. So with the sort of the crystal case that you could partially see through. And that was like one of the photos. Now, I think we've got to give massive respect to the guys off the Atari Age forum because it's these guys that have been like, obviously with it being the Jaguar, they've sort of been on top of it. And they've been investigating sort of every single thing that they've been doing. And they had a look at it. And sort of like realised that the hardware inside the casing turned out to be an old digital capture card. You know, and I think it's like I say, huge respect to those guys because they've like basically called him on it and went, well, you know, you've basically mocked up a fake console.
Now I kind of played devil's advocate with myself there, which is a sad game to play, I've got to say, but I thought, okay, it's a DVR card, but surely there's some processing power on there. Maybe, just maybe, I know this is not going to be the truth, but maybe that could be the platform. That could be the overall processing. Do you know what I mean? Because it's got to have a processor on it and a GPU and whatever else.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking that maybe, actually, they're basing it on that. I mean, it probably transpires as nothing at all to do with that, but I was just sort of sitting there thinking, it could be more to this than meets the eye.
Well, I mean, apparently from what I've heard from these sort of Atari Age guys is they've actually broken down exactly what the processors do on the DVR, the digital capture card, and none of it matches up to, you know, none of it's like, the processor's not there for processing games and graphics and 3D graphics. There's like the sound processor isn't there to create sound. It's all just for recording video and nothing else. It just really does appear as if they've just sort of stuck this in to make it look like they've got some technology inside the case.
Just mad.
It's absolutely mad. And like I say, I mean, we've got to give huge respect to those guys because at the Atari Age forum, because it's like their diligence is basically, they've sunk this project and rightly so. And they've stopped a lot of people potentially losing a lot of money.
Mm, yeah, definitely. And I see one of the founders of the company that was supposed to be making it, Retro VGS, he's stepped down, apologised for it, but saying he wants nothing more to do with it because it is just such a fake. Fake wasn't the word he used, but it was more around how could I be involved with this anymore when it's, you know, we're bang to right.
Well, I believe Coleco have taken the name off it as well.
Yeah, that was the other day, wasn't it? Quite recently. Yeah.
So Coleco have pulled on it. And I think, you know, I mean, just as a retro gamer like you are yourself, you know, just because we like games from back in the day, you don't underestimate the love people have for retro and also the intelligence of the retro community. You know, we might play games from back in the day when we were little kids, but we're not kids anymore, you know, and to coin a phrase, if you feck about with us, you'll get found out.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And I think there's an element of the internet that wants to do that as well. So there's almost a sort of vindictive element on those forums, as well as a genuine element as well, that people just want to tear them apart. If you look on some of the Amiga forums, when, you know, for instance, when Sam was doing his book, there's a lot of people trying to take it down as a bad idea and this is terrible, anyone could do this sort of approach. So there is an element of that on forums, but at the same time, they're hugely intelligent and you can never take away their passion either, because that is what they're ultimately on those forums for, isn't it? Is their passion towards all things that they love, Atari, Amiga, Commodore, whatever.
Of course, you know, and to be honest, Matt, you're always going to get your haters. You're always going to get your haters. That's the internet's full of it. You know, that's basically what they log in for. but, you know, the majority of the retro community, for me, it's one of the most welcoming, friendly and open communities out there, you know, but try and scam us at your peril.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're basically messing about with people's, like, memories, you know what I mean? It's like, you want to bring something new to the table, you better be genuine.
It's a shame, really, because now you've sort of described the initial concept to me, it's actually not a bad idea, other than locking it down and all that sort of stuff. There's a genuinely good idea behind it, but ultimately it was clearly always there to be a bit of a sham.
Well, yeah, I mean, I like the idea, like you say. I mean, like I said, I didn't really understand exactly what the console was, but to have a cartridge-based console again with the, you know, its unique set of games that are put out on it, as long as you could update them, as long as it just could connect to the internet and update your cartridge, so if you got a patch to it, you know, if it had a bug in it or if there was new maps or DLC or whatever, have both. Have it run off the cartridge so it loads immediately like an old-school game, but also have the access to, like, oh yeah, there's some DLC out for it, add it in.
Yeah.
I love the idea of getting a game on a cartridge again. I love that. You know, it's like the special, unique Coleco Chameleon version of it, which is a proper, like, Jaguar-type cartridge.
Well, yeah, it would have been nice. I mean, I got a Commodore 64 game a couple of years ago, delivered to work, one of these brand-new ones that I think I got from probably Cytronic. Is it Cytronic or something like that? And when that turned up, it was boxed, it had a map in it, a map of the game, a cassette. It was a wonderful thing to see that turning up on my desk at work in 2013 for the Commodore 64. So I agree to have seen, I think it had been very niche, whatever happened, but to get something tangible. And I think things are going to go full circle at some point where we're going to see more tangible product out there at some point. It's never going to be mainstream again. But it's like the whole vinyl thing is coming back again, if you believe
tapes are coming back.
Exactly. And I think there's this sort of almost rebellion full cycle that's going on where people want that again. But it's people of a certain age, isn't it? It's never going to be. And it's sad for those folk who are really young, growing up in the digital age. They've got nothing to treasure, have they? You know, their iPod's long since dead, so they've lost loads of music. And their consoles die after about 10 years and all your games go because there's no servers online anymore. So I think there's people of a certain age, us, you know, you're a bit older, obviously, being over the 40. Just wanted to drop that
thanks
in.
Thanks for that, mate.
No problem at all.
Carry on.
That's fine.
It's my bedtime in a minute. It's half 7.
You got your Horlicks on the go. it is a shame. It's a shame, but clearly this was a scam. Or to give them the benefit of the doubt, they have just got in too deep and panicked and didn't know what to do.
It looks to me like he's hit a stroke of luck getting the rights for the Jaguar case.
Yeah, and name behind it.
And the name behind it, and a brilliant bit of concept art of what a cool console could be. And I think that's as far as he got with regards to, like, actually creating the platform. And then he's just seen, you know, the potential of banging it on Kickstarter and making a load of money. Allegedly, I'm just going to throw that word in. Allegedly. Just in case, allegedly. This is what I'm reading about, and this is what I'm hearing from across the net.
And there is a side of the story that no one's heard yet.
Yeah.
And that's the key point. I don't think we'll ever get the full truth, because that side of the story is obviously being, at the moment, pulled together. So Mike Kennedy and whoever else can come to the front and go, this is what we did. We effed up with the greatest respect, and we're sorry. Will it be water under the bridge? Can that guy ever do anything again? I don't know.
I would imagine he's burnt his bridges, to be honest.
Yes.
Very much so.
Absolutely. So, interesting story. Really interesting. I love a bit of drama. When I saw it kicking off, it was kind of like, I've got to follow those threads on Facebook.
Well, it's fascinating when you get a bit of new retro news that's like proper, you know, scandalous.
But at the same time, it's a massive shame. It's a massive shame.
And it is a shame. But, you know, there'll be other projects. There'll be new stuff coming out. You know, it's just, you know, he's blown that one. It's, I'm afraid it looks like it's dead in the water. But I wanted us to talk about it because I, you know, on the off chance that any of our guys, you know, our listeners, our community, whatever, will see that potentially turn up on a Kickstarter or something and just pump their money into it, because it does look inviting at first, you know, just to keep an eye out for these kind of things.
Be careful, people. Yeah. Buyer beware, as they say.
Exactly. So, 3D NES.
3D NES. Tell me more.
So I sent to the listeners there, I sent Matt a link, and I sent the whole Retro Asylum guys a link that I found earlier today. It's for a new emulator, which is called the 3D NES. And it basically takes normal NES games and does what it says. It twists them into like a pseudo 3D. It does it, but apparently does it by converting each 2D sprite in the game into a layered 3D object. Now, what did you think of the video of it, Matt, when I sent it to you?
Just mad. And you know what impressed me the most, and you kind of described it there, is the coding that's gone into this. You know, when Steve says 3D, it literally is, you know, you've got the parallax scrolling on, say, let's take a Mario game, for instance, or I think it was like a Metroid game that I saw. The platforms don't just look 3D. They actually move in a parallax 3D plane.
Yeah,
and when the character went behind one of these tiles, he partially disappeared, as if he was going behind that tile. That's the bit that impressed me the most. I thought, that's not pseudo 3D. That is a genuinely tremendous bit of coding to pull out 3D from sprites, from 2D tiles. Unbelievable.
So clever. So clever. Yeah. So such a nice twist on classic gaming. You know, it's... I mean, I've sent this out to the lads. A few of the Drisks had a go. Paul Davies has had a go at trying to get it running. We haven't had much luck in getting it going at the minute. But to be fair, I mean, it's still a complete and utter beta. Even the video that they've put up themselves, the sound's glitchy. So it's quite obviously got a way off being ready. But it looks really interesting. I just like the idea. You just, like, you know, take your Mario or, you know, I think one of the games was Grisor or the American equivalent, and you rotate it into 3D space, and it works. It's just like, that's mental.
It kind of makes it all relevant again. I know we're on a retro gaming podcast here, so obviously old games are very relevant to us, but, you know, you look at stuff on the 3DS and the Vita and such like, and they've got this stylized retro approach to things now, which has got that sort of 3D effect to it, more real world looking at times. And that almost does that in an emulator, doesn't it, of your old game. So you can load up Mario 3 or New Zealand Story and play it in 3D. Just amazing. Real different take. And I think it's, maybe it will proliferate to other emulators as well down the line, if it's easy enough to do for the wonderful folk who create emulators.
Yeah, it's just like I say, I've never seen anything like it before. You know, I've seen all these filters that they put on in different emulators. They can sort of change it to look like a CRT, or they put weird filters on it to smooth it all out and that, but I have not seen anyone make it 3D before. So yeah, I really hope these guys like pull it off and turn it into a fully fledged emulator, because I would love to play some of the old games. And you don't, you could bring it to other platforms as well, and obviously, couldn't you? This, you know, the Master System, Mega Drive, SNES, whatever, and some of them would just look incredible with this effect.
I guess it gets a little bit harder, because on the NES, I think you've got this restriction of kind of, let's just say arbitrarily, 8x8 tiling, yeah, and that sort of stuff. Where do you get to the other platforms? And while coders limited themselves to that, there was not that sort of hardware limitation of tiling quite like on the 8-bits might have been. Do you know what I mean? So it could be a lot harder when you get up past the 8-bit platforms, yeah, but I could see it happening on the other 8-bit platforms. Yeah, absolutely.
I think especially perhaps if you get up to, you know, like the 16-bit, where you've actually got genuine parallax scrolling as well, that may be taxing just a bit too much to turn that into 3D as well, but you never know.
Yeah, great stuff. Like the sound of that.
Definitely. So let's quickly give a shout out and mention to this new podcast that's sort of seemingly come out of the blue and from nowhere, the Retro Hour.
Yeah.
Now, you initially told me about this, didn't you? About 8 weeks ago, when I think it was around about the first episode.
Yeah, so I followed Dan Wood on YouTube for quite a while now. He's a big Amiga fan. He puts a lot of Amiga sort of biased videos up on YouTube. So I was aware of it coming. And when it did, I downloaded the first one, and it's a really nice little podcast, isn't it? I think for me, they've got it right with the short interviews. I know a lot of people want longer interviews, but I kind of like that hour format. It works, doesn't it? And yeah, I mean, us two being Amiga fans and a bit Amiga bias, and their Amiga bias, probably why it appeals to us so nicely. But yeah, it's great. I think from a competition perspective, it's really good to have more competition, but they've come out of the blocks and it's a really good quality podcast. And it comes from a different angle. While it's still certainly very British orientated, isn't it? It's a different format to Retro Asylum. So they can work together, can't they?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's fantastic to have competition, but it's fantastic to have, you know, another show talking about things that you're interested in. You know, I'm always looking for new retro gaming podcasts, and the more specific they are to the things that I like, the even better. And as you've just said there, you know, we're both Amiga fans massively. That's like my favourite platform, basically. C64 Amiga, that is it for me, massive. And those guys might as well be called the Amiga Hour. Yeah. To be fair, they do cover, you know, a wealth of different things, and they're fantastic with the news. They've covered the Coleco thing massively as well recently. But it's like you said check them out. And I've seen Dan's videos a fair few times. I've actually followed his instructions for setting up WHD load on my Amiga 1200 and other WinUAE guides and stuff. He's like really, really switched on for the Amiga stuff. But I didn't put two and two together that was him. And I'm listening to the first show when you told me about it, and I'm like, I know this guy's voice. I know this guy. I was like listening, and I was like, I couldn't put my finger on it. It's like, has he been on the radio or the telly or something? I totally knew it, and then it clicked. I was like, is that guy off the video? Oh, and yes.
That was it.
Yeah, that was it.
Other people have said that on other forums, actually, because he's actually a radio presenter as his real job.
Yeah, and it shines. It shines.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like a big shout-out to his mate as well, his co-host, it's Ravi Abbott, because the two of them just click. You know, they're both, you know, obviously giving Dan a bit of a shout-out here, but Ravi's just as good, just as much of an Amiga fan as well.
Definitely. So, yeah, we got no qualms in saying check their podcast out, and check out Dan Wood on YouTube as well. If you're in any way Amiga or Commodore 64 orientated, he's got a lot of great videos on there that covers that off, and sits in his bedroom, which is full of Amiga stuff and a Mac and a PC. So it's kind of like, it's like a bedroom porn really for us geeks.
Yeah. So yeah, big shout out to them. Maybe we'll have to try and get them on at some point, maybe do a little interview. So if they're up for that, we'll have a little chat. Four Amiga heads together.
Oh dear.
Well, I think there's a third guy they've got. Is it Joe Fox? I think they have a guy on with them every now and as well, just to not leave Joe out, you know, in case he's listening. But yes, he's definitely, if you're into Amiga stuff and you want some, you know, more UK centric sort of retro gaming podcast stuff, then definitely give the Retro Hour a shout. I mean, we told Drisky about it, didn't you? Within a few hours, he must have contacted them and said hello because they were giving him a shout out. So God bless him. He knows the score, doesn't he, Drisky?
Definitely. Yeah, straight in there.
No messing about with the Drisk. Speaking of the Drisk, anyway, Club Retro Asylum. So our Retro Asylum Club. It's doing great.
Yeah, and what's the email? So what's the email to get involved in Club Retro Asylum? Put you on the spot now, haven't I?
You have put me on the spot now. I'll tell you what, I'll put it in the show notes. I think it's club@retroasylum.com.
I think you're right.
I think it's club@retroasylum.com, but we'll put it in the show notes.
We've done our research, of course.
Done our research. Yeah. I should have asked him that. But it's going great. Yeah, I believe we've now got like way over like 250 members heading towards the 300 mark.
That's great. And it's not some sort of like secret handshake thing where you need to get, you know, come along once a year and touch noses and that sort of thing. It's just... You get, Drisk is currently producing volume 2 of the magazine that goes with it. And you just get to hear about a few other things than if you're not a member. So highly recommend joining up. But that magazine is really, really good. And he's put in...
Has no one told you about the secret handshake, Matt? No?
Not yet, no. No, no, no.
Yeah, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
No, no.
Anyway,
cheers.
So you're absolutely right. It's the magazine is one of the big parts of it. We're onto issue 2. I think we're doing a quarterly one. Mm. He's got issue 2 is nearly complete. And you know, while we've all contributed a little bit towards it, it's really down to Mr. Drisky's hard work.
Definitely,
that the mag and the club is doing so well.
Yeah,
so good work, Mr. Dristle. In fact, while we're here, he's been getting a lot of emails and letters sort of sent in.
Fan mail.
fan mail, or, you know, yeah, well, yeah, fan mail, Drisky fan mail.
Drisky fan mail.
So yeah. I thought I'd read one of the letters out just so you can so we can say thanks basically to these people writing into us. Okay, so this is from Lee from Flint, or his name's Lee Flint. I'm not sure which one.
But he says Keith Flint at all.
Lee Flint could be Lee Flint or Flint. Lee from Flint. He'll know which one he is. He says, please add me to your mailing list for Club Retro Asylum. I love the podcast, really makes my drive to work an informative pleasure rather than a pain. I'm 39 from Sheffield, love video games from the early 80s onwards. I was one of the kids who would spend Saturday mornings loitering around Just Micro and Gemsoft in Sheffield down the street from Gremlin during the 8-bit and 16-bit era. Listening to your show brings back so many memories of those happy times and gives me ideas for retro purchases which I've recently started to get into. I can imagine it's a lot of work and a real passion for you to keep producing the show, so I just want to let you know that there's a lot of gratitude and love out there for what you're doing. Cheers, guys. Lee Flint, or yeah. Lee from Flint.
Lee, it's a sticky slope. It's a downward spiral now you started buying retro stuff, because you will not stop.
Yeah, absolutely. I've just bought a new house and I'm moving in at the end of the month and moved all my stuff into my folks, and one of the rooms is just full of retro stuff. They're not impressed. So, you know, a 40-year-old is carting Mega Drives and SNESs and Megas and crap around with him. But, you know, that's me.
Yeah. So, if you want to send any fan mail or knickers or bras into Drisky, club@retroasylum.com.
Join the fun right now and chat with other retro maniacs. Visit theretroasylum.com or on Twitter @retroasylum1. Get involved now!
Hi, this is Jeff Minter, and you're not listening to one of my sheep. You're listening to Retro Asylum.
So, shall we start getting on to the actual meat and veg?
Let's do it. Okay, so as I said right at the start of the podcast, creative stuff, using your old computers, and I do say computers because consoles was a little bit harder. We'll touch on one console that had a development kit for it, but this is firmly focused on computers. So using your computers for something other than playing games. Now, I certainly did, especially when I got to the 16-bit era. But Steve, what was your thing outside of gaming?
Outside of gaming, music. Mm. It would have been music. We'll touch on to the different things that we used, or that I used on my 8-bit and 16-bit computers. Mm-hmm. But it would have been trying to do a little bit of music on the C64 with a very bizarre add-on that I got for it, which we'll touch upon. Yeah, on the Amiga, it would have been the trackers, the Mod Tracker, Pro Tracker, Octomed, I believe, mm-hmm. was one of them. Like I say, we'll get into this a bit later, but yeah, so basically doing music, trying to do a little bit of graphics, but I wasn't really good at it. And me and my mate using what was called the RSI Demo Maker on the Amiga to try and make demos. So should we wind back a little bit into like the 8-bits?
Yeah, definitely.
Tell me what yours was. What was your...
Well,
was your
I dabbled. Well? It's a bit of a shame, really. I wish I'd have got more into it in the 8-bits, but for me, 8-bits was more about gaming. I did a bit of programming in BASIC on my Commodore and Spectrum as well, and my brother was very into coding on the Spectrum, so he actually finished a number of games on the Spectrum within BASIC as well, no machine code. I kind of missed the boat on that, and I really regret not getting into the Sid music scene. I just had absolutely no idea how to do it. And you mentioned this add-on. I didn't know about that add-on at the time. So I really missed the boat completely. But it was when I got my Amiga was when it really kicked off for me. Like we said in a previous podcast, with one of the trackers, suddenly anyone could become a musician, basically, couldn't they? You know, with the right sounds, anyone could make a tune. So the Amiga, for me, where it was at. Did a bit of coding as well, but yeah, music, and we'll go through what we used once we get to the Amiga days. But I think actually for me, when it got to the Amiga, I was more into the creative side of things, or at least I believe I was, than gaming. I'm not sure you had that same split, Steve.
Probably about 50-50 with me. Me and my mate Paul found a guy in the newspaper who sold pirated games.
As you do.
Yeah, as you do, we called him Mike the Pirater. We'd call him up once a week with our pocket money and a little bit of money, for Paul was in work at the time, and just order a crap load of copy games and mainly play them. But
he sold them as well.
Oh yeah, he was proper
good man. Respect for ruining the whole industry.
He's one of the bad guys. Like, you know. But you know, at this age, I couldn't afford a £39 game or a £30 game. So yeah, you know,
that exonerates you, Steve. That's fine.
Of course it does. Well, yeah. You know, mine and Paul's love of pirated games basically sank our favourite computer. So, so there you go. But yeah, I think I got to the point where I was like 50-50 between like playing all the latest games and absolutely loving it and wanting to try and make stuff. So I started getting these PD libraries, where you get Pro Tracker and the other ones, and I pretty soon found that they had. STO1 or something? It's
called? The Soundtracker discs, sample discs.
The Soundtracker sample discs, and you get different sets with different things in. And I used to love those things. Now, looking back, they're probably so thin on content.
They were. There's about 13 sounds, I think, on them.
You get 13 sounds on a disc, and it would be like a kick, a snare, a hi-hat, a crash cymbal, a bass note, you know, and that was it, you know. But at the time, it was liberating, completely liberating.
And that STO1 sample disc was the sound of the Amiga in the 80s. Yeah. Any game, any demo, any intro that was on anything pretty much used those sounds. And you listen to them now. I've got them all as WAV, Steve, if you want them, just for a laugh. To put into your more modern music productions, but
I think that might be great. Just send me them.
I think we should do a tune. Let's do a tune together, just using those sounds in a modern day music maker pack. I'd love to do that. Let's do it.
Let's do that.
There you go, people. Sound. You heard it.
Watch this space, guys.
Next year, maybe. But yeah, it defined the Amiga sound in the early days because that's all you could get. There was STO2, and it went up to like ST50 or whatever it was. But it defined the Amiga. There's no doubt
100%.
About it.
100%, and I think another thing is, I mean, we've jumped slightly ahead of our flow of, you know, because we've jumped straight to 16-bit here. But for me, like, the Pro Tracker stuff enabled me to do music without having any musical ability at the time. Because it was a case of, like, I later went on to learn to use Cubase on Guitar ST, which that's something else we'll get into, and I now use Logic these days, and I've, you know, worked in studios and everything. But at the time, I couldn't play the keyboard very well at all, I couldn't play the guitar very well at all, and to try and actually create music was complicated. It was complicated back at that point. If you used like a MIDI package or something, it was still complicated, and you needed some grasp of musical ability to make music. But using trackers, it was like a different world. It was like literally you had like 4 channels of sounds that you could use and a repeating list that was just going round and round and round. And you just dropped into that list. So the start of the list, you put a bass drum, then 2 steps down, you do a hi-hat, then 2 steps down, you do a snare and repeat till the end. And it go round in circles. And eventually what you get is, you know, kick, snare, you've got a beat.
Absolutely.
You know, the next channel start doing some bass line and, you know, just typing it in one by one. And with it, before you know it, you've got a piece of music.
Absolutely.
And it's like, you know, and it was like, I can't believe I've made this.
Yeah.
Literally, there was so many times I was like, Mom and Dad, come listen to this. And they come in and it's like, that sounds shit. but I didn't think so, you know what I mean? I was amazed with myself.
Yeah, yeah. But if we go back to the 8-bit, it wasn't as easy, was it, at all? In fact, I said at the start, I had absolutely zero idea of how to make music on my Commodore 64, which I really wanted to do, because obviously I idolised those folk like Hubbard and Galway and all the usual names. I had no idea how to do it. And if you look at the Spectrum as well, I had the beeper in it, which I'm still amazed this day that people got more than beeps out of it. It's actually quite stunning, some of the stuff you hear that... It's actually a genuine tune coming out of one channel and what is deemed a beeper. How on earth did people do that? But
I think, like, you know, I mean, like you said there, but having a C64 with the SID in it, it really made you like hear the tunes coming out of it and go, God, I wish I could do something like that. That's amazing. But it was just so far removed of how you would get in there and actually make it. And, you know, having sort of read about it, you know, now I'm grown up and stuff and like seeing videos like from Rob Hubbard and everything. It's like you had to know a level of coding.
Absolutely.
And understand synthesis and, you know, frequencies and oscillation and everything that was going on there. There was like, they were really, really talented musicians because they made those games sing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that chip sing. And it was full on hardcore synthesis programming.
It was, and they had to know how to code as well to make
and
that
code.
Happen. Yeah, so they developed their own music drivers and so on. So it was a real different world. And if we look at the Spectrum, there was something come out called Wham! The Music Box. And this was sponsored or associated with Wham! The group, George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley. And this was apparently the first multi-channel editor on the Spectrum, and it had a really definitive sound that you could have more than one channel, using this beeper again to make more than one, you know, one sound at one time. Did you look at the video on this at all? It's very primitive.
No, I'll have to check it out. I didn't actually realise that it was Wham! The band. That it was. I thought it was called Wham!
I don't think they coded it, but they certainly were involved in it. And it was, like I say, the drums had a very certain sound to it. You could tell when a tune was done in it. And I think, and this is purely from memory of about a seven-year-old, so forgive me if it's incredibly wrong, I think the music for Trapdoor on the Spectrum was done on Wham! Music Box. So there you go.
Oh, wow.
Claim
okay.
to fame. But it's an interesting thing. I had a quick go on it when I was researching this podcast. It's awful now. There's no question about it. But at the time, 1985, when it came out, there was nothing really else like it. I did see there's a few other music-making packages on the Spectrum around about that time, but really unique, but ultimately useless because you couldn't use it anywhere else, this music. So, but very interesting. Very interesting.
You see, my only recollection of any kind of musical attempt on a Spectrum, when I was a kid, and I must have been about the same, 6 or 7, maybe 8, being at a friend's house and them having, I think it was the Specky Plus 3. Anyway, we got the book out, which teaches you basic, that came with the Spectrum. And I remember seeing part of it was to do with sound and using the beep command.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and so we were typing stuff in and getting it to, you know, we were typing beep and a couple of numbers, followed by another beep and another couple of numbers. And, you know, getting actual sound coming out of it, which was like, you know, as a kid, was like, wow, I've just made it do that. But once again, showing what a world away and how difficult it would actually be to create a piece of music.
Yeah, and I do remember, though, getting those early sort of arpeggiated chords from that beep command, because it was sort of beep, and then it was the length of the note and then the tone of the note was the two syntax you had on that command. And if you did it really quickly and did it in a loop, like a 10 go to 20 type loop, oh, wrong way around, but anyway, you could get a sort of an arpeggiated chord note that was very common with the Commodore 64. But yeah, when you got that beep out for the first time, it was an awesome experience.
Definitely, 100%. But yeah, like you say, it just showed the difference between the 16-bit and that opening up the door to making music, because it had the applications to go with it. And it was, and unbeknownst to them, they created a format as well. Making those tracker programs for the 16-bit, for the Amiga specifically, that was what everyone was using. Games companies were using trackers. You know, if you go on now and look on like mod archives and stuff online, and you download the mod files, you can get the mod files for everything, for every single game on the Amiga, and you can load them up in a mod tracker program.
Absolutely.
So they were all using it. They were all using this same piece of software. But so I wish I'd have been better at it at the time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Christ, that's one regret. One regret. But then you had one thing we've missed completely is basic and machine code, which every platform had some degree of. I mean, every platform had machine code because that's what talks to the computer, essentially, at the end of the day. But basic, which I think, again, from memory, stands for something like beginner's all-purpose symbolic instruction code. Round of applause, please.
I like that you went, it's something like, and then just got it exactly right.
I don't know. It might be slightly wrong. I promise you I've not Googled it or Wikipedia'd it or anything like that.
But sounds good to me.
It's all right, isn't it? It's not bad. But what BASIC was, for those who don't know what BASIC was, if you weren't ever involved in coding or never got the manual out with your Spectrum or Commodore 64, BASIC was English languages that made more sense to us as humans, that we could program into the computer and make it do stuff. Games, applications, draw something on the screen, you know, 10 print, knobhead, 20 go to 10, that kind of thing, which you did in Dixons all the time.
Yep.
What that did was when you typed run, it compiled or converted it into machine code instructions, which the computer could understand. But BASIC was inherently slow because it had to do that conversion all the time. So it was real-time converting your print command into a load of other instructions, which the computer could understand. But as a coder, you could get into those instructions that the computer can understand, machine code or assembler or whatever you want to call it. And that's what was known as kind of hitting the hardware, where you were coding the chips pretty much directly. That was very hard. And like you said at the start, you haven't dabbled in that at all, have you?
No, I mean, you're talking like low-level coding there. You are like really getting right down into the hardware. I mean, I did the same thing as you there. I
I learned how, you know, 10 print, steer is cool, 20 go to 10 or whatever. Every kid in school knew that one. But I think my issue was I really, when I was a kid, really did want to try and become a programmer. I thought it was like the coolest thing on earth. Like, you know, I saw these games come out and, you know, heard about these coders that have made them, and I wanted to do that.
Yeah.
But the problem was, you learned a little bit of basic and you could make the screen flash, or you could make the screen text scroll up and down, or you could get a ball bouncing around and stuff. But then when you got magazines with game listings in them, they literally had didn't coincide at all with what you were learning from basic. Because I remember the listings and it would just be like 10, peak, number, 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 poke, number, just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of lines with peak and poke and loads of numbers. And it didn't make the slightest bit of sense. You were just reading numbers.
Yeah.
And it meant nothing to me. And that was like, I think that's what I assumed that like that the machine code would be like. It was just like, you were just talking like binary.
Yeah, yeah. I think the peaking and poking, you were like putting values directly into the memory locations. But what those typing listings didn't do was tell you what on earth they were doing.
Exactly.
So you just had this massive long list and you'd spend, I don't know, half a day typing it all in with your mate reading it out to you. So yeah, it's peak 225, 149, 349. You'd run it and it wouldn't work. You had absolutely no idea how to troubleshoot that, did you?
Oh no, like, yeah, you just come back syntax error.
Yeah. Oh, damn.
You're like, yeah. Where?
Yeah, turn it off. That's a day wasted.
Give it up. Yeah, yeah. What I used to hate about that as well is that you couldn't like put half of it in and run it to see where you're up to. I would have liked to have gone, I'll put 15 lines of it in, run. Oh, this looks crap.
Yeah.
This is going to be a rubbish game. I'm like, I'll just jib it. Let's do something else.
But wasn't that part of the fun, though, in a way?
Yeah, I suppose.
I don't know. I'm trying to look back on it with rose-tinted glasses and think maybe it was all right. I'm not so sure. But that was coding. I did a little bit of coding, I'd say. Not Commodore 64. It's funny. It's not funny at all. It's a really poor story. But all my games were adventure games, text adventures, like your Zork. They had one or two locations and they always started in a cave. And that was it. That was my game. What you put, look, you can see a door. You try to go through that door and you never got anywhere. That was the extent.
The door is locked.
Yeah, the door is locked. End of game. You're going nowhere. There's no key. So, yeah, coding was big and obviously created a whole scene. And it's great to see that coming back again with the Raspberry Pi and the like. We're seeing a genuine set of back bedroom kid programmers coming through again, much like in the 8-bit days, which is fantastic. Those are a bit more intelligent than me and Steve, can actually make stuff and progress with it and maybe make a career out of it. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of people who are still working in the industry now who cut their teeth on these platforms and in Spectrum Basic or Commodore Basic or Amstrad Basic. It's fantastic.
Absolutely.
It's fantastic.
Well, I mean, I think I've mentioned before that I sort of got a little company making apps, and the guy that I make them with, Dave, started, I think he did a little bit of sort of Commodore Specky type coding, but his main thing was doing it on the Amiga.
Okay.
And that's where he started. In fact, I think we'll get to Amos a little bit later during this chat, but he started on the Amiga, and like, so he's now been coding for like 20 years. So he, you know, he ground his teeth on the 16-bit platform, same as you're talking there.
Mm.
I think one of the things that you can sort of celebrate from all of this is that it set people off in a certain direction creatively. You know, you and me went down a musical path, and it was definitely these platforms that opened the door.
Oh, absolutely.
Certainly was for me anyway.
Yeah, yeah. It sucked my bank dry with buying music equipment all the time that I never really use.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But it, like I say, and it sent him off to become a programmer.
Yeah.
20 years now, and he's a genius at it. He's absolutely brilliant at it. So we've got these humble beginnings to thank.
Absolutely.
For where we've ended up.
Oh, it's amazing. And, you know, coming from music as well, when I'm deep into certain music scenes, and it's amazing how many times I hear people cite the Amiga as their first bit of music equipment that they got tunes released on, certainly in the jungle scene and drum and bass. So many people say, yeah, I used Octomed back in the day, and it's brilliant.
There was commercial releases as well made using the Amiga.
Absolutely.
You know, like, and now everyone will say, oh, well, the Atari ST had Cubase on it and everyone was using that in the studio. But that's not the same thing, because the Amiga, you were listening to the Amiga. The sound was coming from the Amiga. The Atari ST was playing the instruments for you, like taking notes basically on what you were playing. But the Amiga was actually, you were listening to it.
It was.
I think that's amazing.
It was a cheap sampler, wasn't it? It was a cheap sampler. For £400, you had something that was better than the sort of 1,000, 1,500 quid samplers at the time. Maybe not quite as good quality because it was 8-bit versus 16-bit. We won't go too deep into the technical side of things. But you had not just a sampler, but you had a whole music making package, which is just...
And it taught you the basics as well. It sort of taught me, like, you know, we've both gone on to do music and music production and, like, you know, recording actual studios and stuff. And this taught you the very, very basics of how it all worked. You know, sampling, taking an actual sound, turning it into a sample and be able to, like, you know, change it and use it as in a musical sense. Sequencing, which is what, you know, having channels of sound. These are all things you learned back in the day just from these Amiga packages that you've then taken into the studio later on in life, and that gives you that understanding of how it all works.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like you say, humble beginnings.
Probably not from Wham the Music Box. But...
you never know. Someone might have got a career out of it. But if you weren't into coding, then we can talk about the creation packages. And a couple that I remember, Graphical Adventure Creator. So as it sounds, it was a graphical adventure creator. So instead of text adventures, while there was text input, it had graphics. You could draw your own scenes. So if you think Corruption on the Amiga and ST or something like that, or I don't know, Hobbit was a graphical adventure, wasn't it, on way back on the Spectrum. This could create them for you. And it had built into it its own language and parser, so you didn't have to worry about coding all the commands. It had a nice set in there. And I think a lot of games were made in it, actually, because it was just a really good little platform to do it in. It started on the Amstrad, got ported over to, you know, the majority of the 8-bits and possibly the ST. I can't corroborate that. But what a great way to make games. If Graphical Adventures is your kind of thing, it had a built-in graphic editor as well, which was nice. It did what it was supposed to do, and if you had an ounce of graphical ability, then you could make your own graphic adventure in it. Who wouldn't want to do that, really?
Absolutely. So did it come with any did you have any, like, sort of bog standard graphics with it that you could put into your scene, or did you have to draw them all yourself?
I think there was an example game which you could nick stuff out of. You know, rather than having clip art on there, here's a game, this is what you can do, and then it loaded it into the editor and you run it from the editor, so it kind of taught you how to do stuff. And I seem to remember having a massive manual as well, so it was a very good package. Got rated so highly at the time. Really good. Another construction kit, I think, was 3D construction kit. Do you remember that at all, Steve?
Yeah, well, no, I remember games that were made with it or used the same engine.
Yeah.
I remember one going inside. Was it inside a pyramid?
Could well have been something like Driller, possibly.
Maybe that was it. Yeah, it went inside a pyramid. And I remember, like, a lot of companies saying about it being, I don't know if you can hear that ice cream van.
Yeah, is that genuinely an ice cream van?
That's genuine. Would you like an ice cream?
I'd love one. So March the 10th, 8 o'clock at night, I'll have 99. Yeah, 99, do me.
I'm getting a Cornetto.
Crazy. He's really hoping for some business, isn't he?
Oh, he is.
Fantastic.
He's probably selling drugs. Right, Matt, I thought he's about to kick off.
Right, so by the miracles of recorded technology and everything, you are going to not hear, as a listener, any difference from now and hour and a half's time. Steve's going off to watch something about 22 grown men kicking a football around.
Kickball,
that's it. What match is it? Is it Britain versus Iceland or something like that?
It is. It's Brutal Deluxe. it's Liverpool versus Man U. So, and I'm a Liverpool fan, as you probably guessed. So even though you won't notice the passage of time, you may notice the tone of my voice.
I was going to say, the mood may drop.
Yeah, I'll just be like, yeah, I don't remember that one, Matt. No, I don't care. Don't care about sumo construction kit. Don't care about any of this.
So what we'll do is we'll offset this with a bit of music, I think. And then when the music finishes, Steve will be back bright as breezy and we'll continue the podcast.
Okay. Wish me luck.
Cheers. Good luck.
We're back.
Steve, how was it?
We won.
2-0. We meaning Britain.
Yes, Britain versus the rest of the world.
In kick orb. Kick orb. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Spherical orb shaped object.
Yeah, orb boot.
Well, yeah, so you're in a good mood for this bit.
So through the magic of editing, like, you know, 2 minutes later, and now we've won. Yeah, so I'm in a good mood. Let's carry on.
Marvellous. Let's do this. So we just covered off 3D construction kit, and now we're whacking straight into the C64. So Suk. What is Suk, Steve?
Suk is the shoot 'em up construction kit. Yes. Did you have this? Did you play with this at the time, Matt?
Only very little. I've played with it since, though, so I know about it. But who was it by? Because I know this is from famous beginnings, isn't it?
Sensible Software.
Ah, yes.
The legends. I'm sort of back to front of you here because I haven't played with it recently, but I did play with it at the time. I had a crack at it. I fancy myself as, you know, the new Matt Smith. And I don't mean the Doctor Who guy. Yeah, I tried really hard to be good at this when I was a kid, but lack of artistic skill and laziness sort of held me back. I think I created one ship, which in my head I thought it's going to look like something out of Xenon 2, but ended up looking like worse than the little ship in Space Invaders. And then I realised I had to design all the other ships and the explosions and the backgrounds, and I give up.
Yeah, do you know what? That is the barrier for me with a lot of this. When I've done some coding in the past, and yeah, when I had a go on shoot up construction kit in the last couple of years, it's the graphics. I'm not a very good artist. And, you know, that's probably the hardest part of it, because with shoot up construction kit, it allows you to deal with the enemy waves quite easily, sound effects quite easy. The actual game engine's there and running for you, isn't it?
It's brilliant. I mean, considering when it came out, it's absolutely fantastic that, you know, that they give you this software. They were that foresighted to make something that you could make your own game with. I mean, you're getting that kind of thing now for the App Store. And, you know, and this is like 30 years ago. I mean, Sensible Software had the foresight to go, you know, so maybe people want to make their own games. Mm-hmm. And here's the tools.
Yeah, and it's backed up with John Hare, Jules Jobs, whatever you want to call him. Did tutorials in the magazines, Zap or one of them, and so you could see how to make this. And I think it was given away on the front of a magazine eventually as well, which are mad for the amount of creativity you were getting there. That's just unbelievable.
Genius, absolute free. Genius.
Now it is the game engine. I mean, it runs at 50 frames a second. It's smooth as silk. I was shocked when I played on it recently. Played or tried to create something on it recently that, you know, just chuck a ship on screen in a minute flat. All right, it doesn't look very good, but it's smooth. It's silky smooth. The background runs smooth. Just really, really nice.
Yeah, so well built. You've done a bit of research into this, haven't you, Matt? Because aren't they still using it today?
Yeah, so there's competitions going every year, which is run by TND, Richard someone. Sorry, I've forgotten his name now. But yeah, so there's a Suk competition every year where people enter their games, and the games have progressed quite considerably because people are hacking it now. There was, for those that don't know, it was always a vertically scrolling shoot 'em up creating environment, but there's been a hack in the last 10 years to allow it to run horizontally. But people are also doing single screen games on it as well. You're like, you know, Smash TV type thing. So they've been pushing it really hard. Now, don't get me wrong, with any kind of construction kit, you get an absolute load of tosh as well. But it is what it is, and there is a lot of great stuff out there. And it was those competitions that sort of inspired me to try and have a go on it. But like I said, the graphics were the barrier for me. But it's still going strong, and that's testament to how good it is, really. It really is.
Well, I mean, I looked it up because I was reading about it actually not too long ago, and I found one of these competition pages and downloaded like this last year's winner, which was like some kind of harpoon swimming against sharks, sideways scrolling shooter, and it was awesome. I was just like, I can't, you know, this is so cool. This is still going, not even still going strong.
Yeah, still going strong.
Yeah,
it's fantastic, and I would recommend anyone who wants to try out making a game, that's probably the place to start. If you've got any interest in the C64, get yourself an emulator, download Shoot 'em Up Construction Kit, and within minutes you'll have something working. Okay, it won't be the next Iridium 2 or Ikaruga, but you know, it's going to be. I think it'll put a smile on people's faces, won't it? There's a lot of smile for a very little buck, I think you could say.
Got a bang for your buck.
Bang for your buck.
Bang for your buck. And if any of you guys do actually make anything that's worth having a look at, let us know at the old Retro Asylum on the forums, whatever, and we'll play it and we'll review it and we'll mention it on the next episode.
So, that was the first thing on the C64. Now, you can't talk about the C64 without talking about the SID chip.
Definitely.
It's just, we don't need to go into how great it is, but we'll just say it is probably one of the best sound chips ever made that was mass marketed. There were probably better sound chips out there, but this made its mark. It was a synthesizer in a computer that didn't have a synthesizer built on top of it. That has changed since, as we've discussed on previous podcasts, but I regret not getting into SID music, as I said earlier, but you did some, didn't you? In some way, shape or form.
Did I?
You said you got an add-on for it.
Oh, God, sorry, yes. So, no, yeah, right, so with you. So what I got was, I was like, I don't remember programming any SID music.
I remember you from 30 years ago, no.
No, you're right, yeah, sorry. So, yeah, I got, when I was younger, it was called the Incredible Music Keyboard.
Was it incredible?
No. But, you know, it wasn't a bad idea. Basically, it was an add-on that you bolted on top of the C64. It sat on top of the keyboard, and it had a small two octaves of, like, you know, synthesizer piano keys over the top, plastic little keys, and they would actually, well, basically they were just pressed down, like, you know, Q, W, E, R, T, and Y, and letters on your actual keyboard. But it looked like a proper keyboard.
And it
came with some software which, you know, let you record some really basic music and taught you to play a little bit. But what made me laugh was it also came with what was called the Kawasaki keyboard disc, which you would think, oh, Kawasaki, they make proper instruments, this will be immense. But it was made by someone called Kawasaki, who had nothing to do with the music company. And it was basically like a really terrible music demo game thing. It was awful.
As you'd expect with any music creating package, really, wouldn't you? You've got to have some crap demo tunes.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's essentially what this was. But, I mean, it's worth a look. It's a cool little bit of kit.
I've got a story about that add-on that you can get for it. I bought something called Messiah about 5 years ago, and this was a cartridge produced for the Commodore 64, which is essentially a whole music-making environment. You've got a synthesizer in there. For those that know their music equipment, and you probably do, they have the Roland 303 emulator, baseline synth,
nice. Yeah.
And a proper Cubase-style editing package that you could have three voices, or if you had dual SIDs in your C64, six voices.
Nice.
And it was compatible with this add-on.
Nice.
So really nice that it's continued. And I noticed on the video that you popped on our show notes, Steve, that it was compatible with a lot of other stuff at the time, one called SynthCart, which I have a disc for that somewhere. Never used it, though.
Interesting.
So people did utilise it going forward. But could you actually record music, or was it just more about playing along and creating a few sounds?
From what I recall, it had a very, very basic recording feature. But literally just like one voice of notes, and like you play you back. If you played like a four bar loop, you could play it back again. That's what I recall. But what we'll do is we'll throw the I've got a YouTube link for it, so I'll throw it up on the show notes as well, so our listeners can have a look and just see.
It's really interesting, because when we talk about Pro Tracker and Soundtracker again and Octomed again, we won't go too deep into that because I think we waxed lyrical early about it, but you can see the progression from, say, 1983 or 5, whenever this was released, to what happened on the Amiga with the advancements of the computing platform.
Well, it was a revolution, wasn't it, basically?
Yeah. Unbelievable. So I'm gutted I didn't get into SID music making, but as we've found in hindsight, the good stuff was actually programmed in rather than being done on a tracker style utility or something.
I would guess that we were too young, you know, just for this, the skill level involved. It would take a really, really skilled kid. I mean, I know there was one guy what's his name, who worked for Ocean, that Sam's friends with.
Matt Cannon.
Yeah. I believe he started writing when he was young. He was doing music on the C64, like, and I think he was like 15, 16, which is absolute. When you consider like just how difficult it was to make music on the C64, that is some serious skill.
Absolutely.
And talent.
And you can tell if you watch Bedrooms to Billions, a lot of the old folk now that made music in those days have got grey hair. So, yeah, they were probably got 10 years on us, haven't they?
Exactly.
Which is a lot of time. That was them in their teens, late teens. I certainly was like 8, 9 or 10, and you didn't know how to do it. Unless you're a genius kid, you're just not going to be able to.
No. I mean, like you say, our generation, really, for being coming into your creative own was the next, the 16-bit platforms?
It was. So just to wrap up sort of the 8-bits, I know we've not really covered the Amstrad, don't know too much about the Amstrad per se, and there's obviously the whole wealth of MSX and all that sort of stuff. The C64 and the Spectrum were the two places where the majority of us cut our teeth in getting creative in the early days. Just other points to note on the C64, Koala Paint, which I think was one of the first tablet drawing artist packages.
Yeah, I believe so. Never used it myself, but I think it was the first one with a tablet.
Yeah. So that's a really interesting concept, the fact that tablets are really, really popular now, and Apple with their Magic Tablet as well, you know, started in those days. And I don't think it was unique to the C64 either. I know it came out on the Atari, one of the Ataris as well. So, but yeah, that's kind of the 8-bit era. And of course, like we said earlier on, Machine Code. The C64 was really friendly as a hardware machine to code on. I've since learnt a bit about the sort of machine code world on the C64. And when you look at it in its rawest format, you think, actually, it's quite easy to get things going quickly, getting sprites on screen, taking joystick input. It's a real piece of cake. Obviously, when the game logic comes in, that's when it gets difficult.
But yeah,
it's a friendly computer to program on. So I think if you want to learn something assembler-wise, machine code, C64 is where to go, because it helps you along. It does scrolling in hardware. It does sprites in hardware. You don't need to write your own routines. It's all there ready for you. It's a great, great little machine, as we all know.
C64, we salute you.
Yes, we do. Spectrum, we do as well, though.
And a Specky. Well, you were a Specky kid, weren't you?
Originally. Yeah, I moved to the C64 from the Spectrum.
I think the word's upgraded.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'm sure our fellow co-hosts wouldn't agree with that.
They'll agree with that. I can see them reaching for the stop button now on the...
hold on. Stop the press. I've just got a text from Dean, Paul, Andrisk, and Matt. They all love the C64, they said.
Oh, yeah, well, they secretly do, you know. This is, yeah, you know, on our chat forum that we have. they wax lyrical about the C64 and the Amiga all day. Well, mainly the C64 and how much better it was than the Spectrum. So,
well, you can tell that. I think they do the 8-bit wars shows with a bitterness in their voices.
Exactly. Yeah. They let me win last time. They wanted me to win. I won for all of us.
Well done, Steve.
Anyway.
On to...
Moving on.
The piece de resistance, I think, is the Amiga. And I think a caveat was saying the ST had some fine stuff about it. I just don't know a huge amount about it. But we have got a couple of bits we'll come on to on the ST. Because I think it, you know, looking back nowadays, a very capable machine. But the Amiga is both where our passions are and actually, I think, where a lot of people in the world of gaming now progress their teeth and cut their teeth, I think.
Definitely.
Without a doubt. I mean, you're saying your partner with the app company started in Amos. So what better place to start? Amos. What did you do in Amos? And what is Amos, first and foremost?
So Amos is, let's just read this little... That's literally your notes, in fact, Matt. You're the one who's done the research here. I'll just sound like I know what I'm talking about. It was a high-level BASIC from 1990 by Francois Leonette. Originally STOS, released on the ST, imported to the Amiga to make use of the Amiga's custom hardware. So, and essentially, they made it better.
Yes.
And famous Amos games would be Scorched Tanks, Valhalla, and other Vulcan software, Jet Strike, Base Jumpers, tons of PD, and some demo scene demos. So essentially, it was a new form of BASIC that was developed, or ported from EST, and improved to make use of the custom hardware in the Amiga. But what it really was a way for people who couldn't get to grips with machine code and, you know, all the intricate coding that we were talking about before, but could actually utilize the power of the Amiga through sort of, you know, a similar form of BASIC, as you were saying before, that a programming language that uses English words in the English language and makes kind of sense to people. It give them a hands-on to actually get to grips with some of the power of the Amiga and make demos and games that were, you know, maybe not AAA titles, but certainly touching up there with, you know, real commercial releases.
Absolutely. And Amos was so bloody easy as well. To put a graphic onto the screen was a matter of a couple of commands to open a screen in its own right. So you had to go through the concept of opening a screen to begin with so you could put stuff onto it. It's one command. Fantastic. I mean, its downfall was it wasn't very optimized in terms of you couldn't do a lot of CPU intensive stuff because it would start grinding a little bit. But if you worked around its limitations, such an easy environment, quite a nice editor as well. And you kind of had everything there for you, didn't there? Because there was graphics packages built into it. It could load ProTracker modules, no problems at all. It was ready and waiting for you. It was a proper development environment, but you had to learn to code. great manual as well. I think it was had a lot of errors in it, but at the same time, it was a really, really good manual.
Well, I mean, some of my mates like learned some basic programs with it, and they raved about it. They absolutely raved about it. And I would be impressed, you know, when they'd show me stuff that they made. It would be basic games and stuff, but it would be sort of at the level of what you would have made with the Shootmore construction kit. That kind of level of, like, you know, smooth scrolling, 40 frames a second, depending on what you've made, but, you know, getting decent graphics on screen, putting your own music into it. Yeah, it was the complete package.
It was. And there's talk recently that the guy who wrote it, Francois Lunette, or however you pronounce that, is going to produce a Java version, I think, or something like that. So to be completely compatible with Amos, but for the modern day.
That's cool, man. So you'd actually be able to go and make new stuff.
Yeah, new stuff, or load in your old stuff.
Nice. Really
nice. How good is that? And following on from Amos, Blitz Basic, which came a little bit later, was a lot more optimised. It was another basic programming language, but it was a little bit more complex, and you could put machine code in line as well. And I'm not sure. Now I say that, I think you could do that on Amos as well, but Blitz made a big thing of it. And key Blitz games, well, What Bigger Than Worms was done in Blitz.
Nice.
Yeah, no, then Skidmarks, Super Skidmarks, and so on. But Worms, I mean, the whole Worms IP started in Blitz Basic. Great.
That's impressive. Was that the Wormageddon, which was the demo that Team 17 bought, or is it Team 17's first release? Do we know?
I'm not sure. I think the original, that even before it was called Worms, before it got Worms put into it, was done in Amos. And then he moved, Andy Davidson moved over to Blitz Basic for the Wormageddon that you mentioned there. I believe that's the way it goes. Don't quote me on that, people, though. Please don't quote me on that.
Impressive. Yeah. So let's jump on to sampling, then.
Oh.
Falling into our own little arena here.
So good. So many memories.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've listed down a couple of bits of hardware. You've mentioned Technosound Turbo, the Audio Master, and the Aura. I think the Technosound Turbo was the one I had. Was that like a cartridge thing that went in the back of the Amiga?
I say it went in the parallel port, little sort of fag packet sized thing.
Yeah, and the audio in and out.
Yeah, connectors. So, I mean, it wasn't the best sampler in the world, but I remember the Christmas that I got it, and it was in heaven, because I'd never been able to do any sampling before. It was always using other people's sounds, and then suddenly you got this, and it just, at the time, it almost opened up these infinite opportunities, didn't it?
Oh, amazing. Well, at the time, I must have been about 17 at this point, 16, 17 when I had this. I'm maybe a bit younger. I was doing a bit of sort of work experience in a local studio.
Oh, excellent.
And they had, what was it? It was a Roland sampler.
750?
Might have been.
Had its own TV and mouse and everything.
Didn't have a TV. It was like a little tiny LCD screen on it, little blue light up screen.
Yeah.
What I did know is that it was £2,000.
Yeah.
And what I did know is that it would max out at about 12 seconds of sampling. And the idea that this thing that I was using in the studio, which was so expensive and was a proper piece of hardware, it was like two racks sized screw-in piece of hardware by Roland, I was doing almost the same thing on my £300 Amiga at home.
And I actually think that Roland sampler was only 12-bit quality as well, so it wasn't hugely better than the Amiga was on 8-bit.
Well, to be fair, the Amiga, I could see the WAV on screen, and I could cut and tail it and trim it and change the audio levels with a mouse, whereas on the Roland in the studio, I was sitting there pressing dials, bringing up menus, using knobs and buttons, and this tiny little display that showed about 12 characters. So that I was actually getting a better digital experience on the Amiga for, I mean, £40 Technosound Turbo.
Yeah.
Nuts. Yeah. Absolutely
such a
nuts.
Great bit of hardware. And yeah, like I say, £40 and you could sample infinite amount of sounds. Such a good, I've still got mine somewhere. I can't remember where it is at the moment, but just seeing it when I pulled it out of a drawer a few years ago just took me back to that Christmas of getting it and spending hours sampling, then cutting up your samples, getting little hi-hat stabs from house tunes, and it just opened up that whole world. And I think I was using Octomed at the time as well.
The only issue we had was the time that it was, when it actually came out, is that I didn't really have access to any decent instruments that I could plug into it to sample and nick the sounds from, because obviously those instruments, you know, if I wanted like a Roland or a Moog or a Korg or something to plug into it, they were thousands of pounds as well, and I had no access to them, because they would have been perfect to just go, I'll just use this Moog, I'll just nick that sample, and I'll just nick that one. Unfortunately, because music equipment at this time and this era was so expensive, that the only thing I could really plug into it was like my Walkman line in.
Absolutely.
Or a Ghetto Blaster line in, and then just get a little bit of a, like, you know, hear a sample out of a track or something and go, oh, I'll have a bit of that. So that was the only downside, is like not having access to the instruments that could have put into it to make it all singing, all powerful.
Yeah, I mean, you look at someone like Ali Brimble, and you can, I remember seeing his interview in, say, CU Amiga or Amiga Format, and he had the same sort of setup of us, but he had the Korg M1 and he had another set of hardware, and you just think, because there was a little bit more money, however he got his money, he was able to sample in all these, you know, all these chords and everything off of a genuine synthesizer, which made his music that much better. Until sample CDs come about, though, Steve. You know, when Zero G and the like started bringing out their sample CDs, then you could get the sounds, because they were just full of these sounds, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that opened it up for everyone. So sampling, for those that don't know, sampling is taking a recorded bit of music or a sound and then digitizing it into your computer. And in those days, it was digitizing it into your Amiga. And it turned your Amiga into any instrument, essentially. And then you would sequence it in something like Octamed, which we discussed earlier, which I cut my teeth on that, and you did too.
Absolutely. And I think this is the thing. This is why the Amiga sound chip and the Amiga's music is so much better than anything else that was going on at the time. It just smashed it out of the park, because it was a sampling sound chip. So it could literally play anything. Literally, just down to, it was only limited by a number of channels. Even Octamed pushed that from 4 to 8 later on in its life. And memory availability. So you'd have to, if it was actually the sound for a game or something, then you were constricted by how much sampling and how much sound you could use.
And I think that's where the creativity come into it, didn't it? When a developer said to the musician, you've got 30K of disk space and this much memory to create a tune and all the sound effects for that tune in. That's where it got creative. So the likes of me and you that weren't making tunes for games, we could make our songs as big as we liked, samples as big as we liked. It didn't matter. And that's probably why we didn't make it into computer game music, because I certainly didn't understand the concept until I got into the demo scene, when I was told, you're using up way too much space here, I need a lot less. I didn't get that concept at all. It was like, why do these games' music in some cases not sound very good? I just didn't know, didn't understand.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I was the same, sort of like, I'll come on to sort of making demos in a minute, because there's another little bit of Amiga software that I used to use for making demos. It was the same thing. Like, when we got to that point, it was like, no, you can't make a 500K masterpiece. It's going to be 30K if you want anything else to happen.
Yeah. And the reason you're getting knocking off my mic as well is I'm getting really excited about this. I'm moving around. So listeners, I'm just getting excited here. I am fully clothed though, just to make that clear.
Thanks for that.
That's no problem at all. So what other music packages were on the Amiga other than trackers? We had some MIDI sequencers, didn't we?
So yeah, Bars and Pipes and Music X are the two that you've listed here and two that I recall.
Yes. I remember Bars and Pipes. I think they both got given away on magazines at some point as well. And I don't know whether I got this right, but I'm sure that William Orbit produced some Madonna tracks in Bars and Pipes. But Bars and Pipes was just a MIDI sequencer, wasn't it? So it was just sending notes out to external equipment.
Yes. Now, I did use, I think it was Music X. I used Music X for a short while because I did get a MIDI add-on for my Amiga so that I could connect it up via MIDI and like play the sounds out of keyboards. By this point, I'd got a couple of keyboards. So we're moving a bit further forward now in the time scale as well. This is after, it's a year or so later than when I got the Technosound Turbo. Now, like, sort of like starting to just, for Christmas and presents and saving money and stuff, get a couple of different instruments. Excuse me. And I got a MIDI keyboard as one of them. And so that was where I did get a plug-in for MIDI and attempt to record MIDI music on Music X. But I wasn't on it for very long before I switched over to Cubase on the ST, which is something we'll go to in a minute.
But it's horrific, though, Music X, in terms of just looking at it now. It just looks complex, incredibly complex.
It was, from what I recall, it was a nightmare. I think it was the one thing that forced me out of the Amiga camp for MIDI purposes and over to the ST. Just for me, I didn't leave it for anything else. I still kept the Amiga.
Yeah.
Just for MIDI recording. And obviously, like I say, we'll get into Cubase in a minute, but that was also what I was using when I was doing the stuff in the studio, was Cubase, so that's why I moved over to that. But yeah, I'm not much experience apart from that. I had Music X for a short while, didn't use bars and pipes at all.
No, I tried it once, it just didn't click with me at all, because I was so used to the whole tracker vertical, like you said earlier, just putting down notes in a vertical format, that I didn't get that horizontal timeline sort of flow that I think bars and pipes had.
Yeah,
and Music X just confused the hell out of me, because it was all numbers and hex, wasn't it?
Something yes.
like that.
Ooh. Yeah.
horrible. So that's music on the Amiga. There was, like Steve has said, it just allowed you to, it was just better than any other platform for music at that point in time, because it had such a great sound chip, and that sound chip lived throughout the life of the Amiga, showed how good it was. It did get limited in its later life, there's no doubt about it, but you could still bang out a good track on it, you still put good sound effects into games. So then we move on to Deluxe Paint.
Da, 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 da.
Tell us about Deluxe Paint.
God, Deluxe Paint was, well, it's the forefather to Photoshop, isn't it? It really is. I mean, it was the original and the best. And like, I recall when like Amiga adverts were on the telly when it was first coming out, there would be the picture of, it was like a woman's face with hair.
Oh yeah, of course it was, yeah, yeah. God, she's probably a famous person or a famous, yeah. Not a person, a
famous piece of art.
A thing in the sea. What are they called? Mermaid.
A mermaid, yeah, mermaid. Yes. I was trying to think of that. I think she was sat on a rock or something.
Yeah,
I always caught that on the adverts. And who was the pop artist as well?
Andy Warhol.
Andy Warhol, yeah. So this was always shown in the adverts. That was like showing off Deluxe Paint and showing off like, you know, amazing pictures. The other thing that you saw on one of the pictures was the Sphinx face. Yeah.
That was on the cover as well, wasn't it, of the box?
Yeah, and it was just like, I can't believe that's been made in an Amiga. It looked like a photograph to me. I was just like, that looks amazing. But yeah, it was the original sort of art package that started teaching you tools that you've taken forward to this day. So, you know, like selecting an area and coloring it in, having a tab, a swatch of different colours down the side. A lot of the menu features, the draw, the pencil, the straight line, the circle, the square, they're all still with us today. And this was the original.
It was. Know. And it was bundled with Amigas, you know, right from the 500 to the 1200. So many people had a copy of it. And I would say that over and above any other creative bit of software on the Amiga, that was probably the most used one. Not just because it was given away with it, because it was so accessible. Like you say, it gave us that paradigm of how to use an art package, but it was because it was so easy. Anyone could just jump into it and draw something. Probably wasn't very good, but you could draw something, couldn't you, within a minute?
Oh yeah, and you could, if I remember rightly, you could zoom in as well, so you get sort of down to pixel level.
Absolutely.
Drawing, yeah. Which made it fantastic for like pixel artwork, which wasn't even pixel art back in the day, it was just art, because that's what you were doing. But for like sprite design and stuff like that. I've got an interesting sort of story. Around the time, I think Deluxe Paint 2 or 3 was out, I'd had my Amiga for a couple of years, and a guy was advertising in a Liverpool newspaper that he was selling, I don't know, something like 20 boxed Amiga games for like 15 quid.
Mm-hmm.
An absolute bargain. So I was like to my dad, can we go and get it? He's like, yeah, I'll drive you around. So it was a few miles away in a place called Sefton Park, and we got there. And he's like, oh, come in, I'll show you the boxes and the discs and everything. And I went in, and this guy had an Amiga 3000 set up. Yeah, and I was like, whoa, he's got... And I hadn't really seen like a desktop Amiga before. And I was like, wow, what's this? And he's like, I've got Amiga 3000. I was like, wow. And then I noticed on the screen, he had Deluxe Paint 3 open, and he had images that looked like a robotic bad guy monster thing, like something you see in a game, like from a shoot 'em up or a scrolling beat 'em up. And I was like, whoa, what's this? Like that. And he goes, oh, I'm a graphic artist. I work for, I think it was Ocean. Was it Ocean? They had another team that worked in Liverpool now, but Doc. Oh,
Denton Designs, someone like that?
Might have been Denton Designs, was it? Whoever it
Special
was, anyway.
Effects. Special effects, Denton Design. That's all I can remember.
It was one of them. It was to do with Ocean. I think it was one of the sublet companies that was in the Albert Dock in Liverpool. But he was like, oh, yeah, I'm a graphic artist. I do animation and sprites for blah, blah, blah. And I was like, what's this for? And he's like, oh, it's one of the bad guys for a game called Midnight Resistance is coming out. And I was like, whoa. And he just did freelance graphics, and I was just like, walked away, just like going, wow, that's how you actually use that package.
Yeah.
And that's what it really looks like if you know what you're doing. because it was just like, it just looked like he'd just taken a sprite, a really cool looking sprite, straight out of a game and dropped it into Deluxe Paint. And that, and he had it, it was like he was clicking 1, 2, 3, 4, I think it was, or something across the keyboard, and it was jumping through the frames. Because I think by Deluxe Paint 3, you can animate as well.
Three. You have something like 13 frames of animation or something.
Yeah, and he was flicking through them, just showing it, like animating, or like, you know, robot arms moving around or something. I was just like, that is amazing.
Fantastic. Another famous use of animation in Deluxe Paint was catchphrase. So you, for those non-UK people, catchphrase is a classic UK game show presented by the mighty Roy Walker. And Mr. Chips was done on the Amiga. Deluxe Paint.
I never knew if it was, but I always thought it was when I was watching it. I was like, this has got to be an Amiga.
Yeah, maybe it was a myth. I don't know. And another one, and I'm sure I've said this before on a podcast. Do you remember the chart show on ITV? All the graphic overlay was an Amiga.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was using a Genlock, wasn't it?
Genlock, yeah.
That's how they do it. Yeah.
And I think we all found out because it was the Amiga mouse cursor. Mouse cursor. And it was like, oh, wow, that is an Amiga. So there you go. There's a couple of claim to fames and probably all done in Deluxe Paint initially, graphically, and then plonked on the screen. But yeah, really sort of a seminal package, Deluxe Paint, is, like you say, it paved the way for future art packages. And I'm pretty sure I've read developers' blogs and such like where they said they've been using Deluxe Paint up into sort of the PlayStation 1 days for textures and, you know, title screens and that sort of thing. So,
well, like I said about it being the forefather's Photoshop, I think Sam was telling me that some of the keyboard commands from Deluxe Paint are still the same keyboard commands in Photoshop.
That's how deep it runs.
Yeah, and I think you can still save in the Deluxe Paint format or the Amiga format, whatever it is.
IFF.
Yeah, I think there is an option to save an IFF file. Blimey. Or there was up until recently.
Yeah, excellent.
I find amazing. So, yeah, there we go.
What a package. I mean, there was so much more you could do on any of these packages, Amiga especially, because it was such a popular platform. There was just so much you could do with graphics, music. Steve mentioned Genlock in there, which was putting graphics over live TV or something like that. You had the demo scene, obviously. I mean, that's a massive, deserves a podcast on its own, but I don't think we'll ever do that. But the demo scene was a massive creative outlet for so, so many people.
Oh, God, yeah.
That it was equally as big as probably the game scene, but except it wasn't commercial, it was underground. So there's just so much that the Amiga bought to the masses, I think, really. You know, okay, a PC could do the same later on, the ST could do kind of some of it, but there's just something about the Amiga that had all this available that me and you and the average Joe on the street could get down and dirty with.
Absolutely. Well, before we jump off the Amiga, one of the other things I wanted to quickly mention was the RSI Demo Maker. I don't know if you remember
this. I've never used that. Never used it.
Yeah, I think, was it Red Sector 1? RS1 demo maker then. I got this on a PD disc. And basically, it let you make your own demos. It wasn't amazing, but it would let you put your own tracker mod into the song. You'd have a couple of them. It'd let you do your own, what's it called? Like a crack screen when you booted it. With the text scrolling across and the greets and all the rest of it and the cool graphics and that. And then basically, so you could do that. You could do a couple of 3D animations and you could do screenshots of like stuff you made in Photoshop or any images you had to music. So like me and my mate thought, we can make money out of this. We're going to be rich. So because we had a few mates who had Amigas and that. So we decided like we're going to make our own like demo making group. We called Digital Eclipse. What a stupid name.
Not bad.
Yeah, it's quite poncy, isn't it, really? You have 2 16-year-olds. Digital Eclipse, yeah, so like a business. We called ourselves Digital Eclipse, and we spoke to our mates and that. I was like, look, we'll make you a demo, but we'll like put your name in it, and we'll put your name in the scrolly thing at the beginning, and like, you know, we'll draw your name in big like graphic images and stuff, and like, you know, in Photoshop, and we'll have that as the images and that. I think we've got like one mate out of all of our mates who paid us a fiver for one, and that was it. And even he wasn't impressed with it.
I bet he wasn't.
Yeah, but once again, it was just another package that allowed you to just like be creative and make something that you could show off to other people.
And I just want to correct there, Steve, because people might be thinking you had Photoshop in the Amiga and they'd be going like, wow,
sorry.
How did that happen?
Deluxe Paint. Deluxe Paint. But, I'm still on a high from winning the match. It's fine.
Oh, yes, it's true, isn't it? It's no, I won't go there. But yes, so the Amiga, very, very creative. But the ST, let's not leave the poor old ST out. What did that have? And that was, so like you said earlier on, people would say, well, the ST was in music studios and so on. And absolutely it was, because of its built-in MIDI capabilities. Cubase come out on it. And, well, you used it. I never really used Cubase on the ST. So tell us about Cubase.
So, I mean, I have used Cubase for almost 20 years. I don't use it as much now. The sort of studio that I go into and work with, the couple of guys that I work with, I won't name drop because you told me off last time I did that.
it's Lee from Blue and...
And all the other people from Blue, yeah. that we don't even know the names of. This studio that I go into, we're still using Cubase in there, so I still use it, you know, once a week. But at home, I use Logic. But anyway, sort of winding backwards, I cut my teeth on Cubase on the ST. And as I said before, I tried using MIDI on the Amiga and just found it to be a bit of a mess because it wasn't a generalized system. Didn't have it built in. It was a bit of slightly an obscure thing to have on an Amiga. So
as an afterthought, really, isn't it?
It was an afterthought, yeah. Whereas on the Amiga, it was set into the hardware, set in stone. On the ST when it came out, it was set into the hardware and it was set in stone. So they developed software for it. And Cubase was the first proper professional sequencer on the ST. And that went into studios. You would see, if you look at like documentaries of bands from the 80s and even the early 90s, you'll still see them. I think... Fatboy Slim still uses one now. Uses Cubase.
And I think it was the first one to use the proper horizontal timeline with a piano roll style editing.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure of that. But I think the MIDI built into it was really Atari's major trump card. And that probably sold, I wouldn't say as many as into the, you know, the consumer market, but it just kept their foothold for longer than what was expected, I guess.
It kept it alive, and I mean, I would hesitate to wonder what would have happened to the ST had it not had that. You know, because that turned it into a professional piece of kit. It turned it into a professional piece of audio equipment for studios that could be relied upon. Its MIDI capabilities were fantastic. They were rock solid.
And that's the point you just hit on there, rock solid. And I know people who still hark back to the fact that Logic is not a solid MIDI, you know, Cubase... Pro Tools even, you know, high-end studio stuff, not as solid on the MIDI capabilities as Cubase on the ST. So that speaks volumes, doesn't it?
It was. It was absolutely rock solid. I mean, like I say, I learned that in the first studios that I went to. And then I went to college in Newcastle and carried on learning music production. And we had Atari STs and we had Macs. No Amigas.
No.
But once again, that shows how relied upon it was that even when I was learning music in like Newcastle in university, they had Atari STs in the studios, you know, and that just shows the level of like, you know, the capability that it had.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got a mate who still makes music, and you know, he's got Logic, uses Logic quite heavily, uses Ableton as well, and he's got loads of outboard equipment. But recently, because he makes jungle to this day, he's gone back to just using an ST and an Akai sampler, and he says there's just something about it that clicks within, because there's a kind of limitation. There's the rock solid nature of the way it triggers notes. And again, it speaks volumes that people still want to use it to this day. And I think there was some sort of floppy drive emulator that came out for the ST recently, and that sort of kicked everyone back in. Oh, wow, I could get Cubase for the ST again. Reliably get Cubase for the ST again, rather than running off floppy disks.
Yeah.
So, yeah, really, again, like Deluxe Paint, was very Amiga focused. ST was all about MIDI and Cubase. There's no doubt about it. And later on, the Falcon as well, which kind of didn't really fulfill its destiny, did it? But that had fantastic DSP chip in it, kept the rock solid MIDI that the ST was known for, but just upped the processing power, but it didn't really get anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, that should have been a real proper rival to the Amiga, even on a gaming level.
Mm.
Because as far as I recall, it had much better graphics as well, didn't it? Not better graphics than the Amiga, the sort of 1200 AGA, but it had much better graphics than the previous ST.
It did, and a much faster processor. It had a 68030 processor in it, whereas the Amiga 1200 had the 020, and this amazing DSP audio chip in it as well. 32 channels of sound or something along those lines. And I remember I made a decision between the Falcon and the Amiga 1200. I can't say I'm disappointed going for the Amiga 1200, but it had been very interesting having a Falcon. And that was purely for its music capabilities that I wanted it.
Yeah, I mean, I really never had a proper go at it. I do remember it coming out and thinking it sounded pretty damn impressive. But I switched to the 1200. I was just too inbred with the Commodore by this point. It's just, there was no way out for me. It's a great piece of equipment, and you know, definitely worthy of a mention on the creative level.
Definitely. So the ST, while it didn't have so much in like the Amiga had, just Cubase made its name, still used today, speaks volumes, doesn't it? Really.
Absolutely.
Massively. So before we finish up this podcast, there's one console I think we need to talk about, and probably quite close to your heart with the company you work for, Steve, is the PlayStation 1 had its own amateur development kit called the Net Yaros. Is that how you say it?
I used to call it Yarosi. But I really don't know too much about it. All I do remember is that they sort of went, oh, you can make your own games on this.
Yeah, so doing a little bit of research about it. So I knew that you got a black PS1 with it, and it wasn't region locked down, so it was region free. Released in 1997, cost around about £500-550 in the UK, probably sort of $700-800. But, you know, by that point, 1997, there really wasn't the back bedroom coding scene anymore, because the Amiga had died out, you know, all bar the hardcore fans. Obviously, the 8-bits were long gone. And it was all kind of console, wasn't it? Other than PC, of course, which always had its creative side to it. But even they were a little bit out of mine and yours, probably budgets, because you had to spend sort of a grand to get a decent PC at the time. So this allowed back bedroom programmers back into it. And some sort of commentary I read today that people were saying that's the very start of the indie scene was this Net Yarosi, Yaros, whatever you want to call it. And a lot of people who started on there have gone on to continue developing in the indie game scene now and big studios as well. So it's definitely worth a mention that I know nothing about it particularly other than it existed, and it allowed the likes of you and me, if you had £500 in your pocket, to make games for the PS1. I mean, that must have been quite awesome, mustn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it really should have. But I would love to know what titles were made for it by bedroom coders that succeeded.
Well, I'm not sure any got released commercially. They might well have done, but it was the official PlayStation magazine really helped it along and started publishing stuff on the cover every month. And there was a lot of competitions that went on, you know, development competitions. So it was pushed by Sony to a certain degree. And there is, I can't remember the name of it now, something like Tilt or something like that, which was one of the seminal games on it, and a football game called... So I think it's called Football Yaros. And it looked really good, actually. But I don't recall any of the games on it. I was not big into the PlayStation at the time anyway, so I'm probably the wrong person to be talking about it. But I just think it's really worth a mention that in the times of, you know, console dominance, Sony had the sort of vision to release this. And, yeah, it probably set the scene for what we now know as indie gaming.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? But my concern with it would have been is that it come out at a time when we were switching up to the 32-bit consoles and the push into 3D. And people were moving away from anything that would have looked like Amiga 16-bit, SNES, even 2D. I mean, everyone was just like, went ballistic, didn't they, for 3D games. It was just like, this is the future. It's amazing. Look at Tomb Raider, blah, blah, blah. or as I see it, the end of good gaming.
Yeah.
personally. But what I'm saying is that the public was just like had this desire for 3D and epic games and big musical score and big explosions and as much as you could possibly throw at a game to excite someone. So to open it up to like an indie developer, like a bedroom coder or a couple of bedroom coders, it would be so difficult for them.
Yes.
Because they would have such a small team and such small development money to, like, you know, to make their assets and make their 3D assets and make their physics engine and make, you know, music and everything else that the big developers were doing. Because if you know, as you will have done, if you read anything of the history of gaming, when we went into the PlayStation era, the development costs just went skyrocketed. Yeah. Astronomical. It just, you know, times 10,000 or whatever. You know, you could have three guys making a game on an Amiga or five guys making a game on an Amiga. Suddenly you need 100 guys to make a PlayStation game. So I mean,
Most famously, John Hare says that was the end of Sensible Software, wasn't it? When they tried to make a 3D game for the PlayStation.
Exactly. So even though the idea of the PlayStation opening it up to go, yeah, you can do this in your bedroom. It's like, can I? If I can get another 50 people with me, maybe I can. I like the concept. I like the idea that they opened it up, you know, and just went, you know, we're not going to close this down. If people want to make their own games, they can. Here you go. Here's the tools. But realistically looking at it, it's like, how on earth would you be able to? It's like me and you saying we'd like to do SID music in the C64. It's like, yeah, I'd love to do it, but I just haven't got the skills or the tools to
be
able to.
We had no idea. We had no idea, did we?
Exactly. Yeah. But what is interesting about that is that we've come forward, and Sony seems to have done it a few times, to be honest, because I think the PS2 was locked down. I don't remember any kind of development kit for that. I might be wrong. Anyone shouting at me. But I know the PS3, you could put Linux on it, which is interesting. They sort of unlocked it, part of it, so you could have Linux running as a second operating system and had some access to the graphics chips. So with Sony once again saying, we'll open our console up to you to mess about with, and obviously PS4, and the Vita, they've sort of really welcomed the indie scene. Massively.
Yeah, I love what I'm seeing in the indie scene now. It's very interesting hearing that interview that Paul Davis did with Shahid.
Yes.
And it really rung true where I think Paul said, the Vita now, people are buying just for indie games. Because actually, there's not a lot of AAA titles coming out on it that I can see. You can't go to Amazon and find a AAA game specifically. But it's just rife with really, really good indie games. And I think there's the difference on a platform like that, where Sony have opened it up again, is there's an element of quality there. Whereas, like we were talking before we started recording this show about App Store and apps on like iOS and Android, it's just so much out there and so much crap that you can't see the wood for the trees if you're a developer.
Yeah, swamp. Total swamp.
But I think there's some sort of quality control going into the Vita. I don't know whether Sony have to sign them off or whatever, but there just seems to be an element of quality there which is missing on your app stores for your mobile devices.
No, 100%. And I think the nice thing is now is we've come full circle. We've come full circle to the point where you can have 2, 3, 4 people make a game now on the PlayStation 4 and the Vita and the Xbox One. Don't take anything away from that, even though I don't like it. It's rubbish. But that door has been opened again, and we've come to a point where people have got to not everyone, but they've certainly gone, yeah, I'm a bit bored now with your AAA, fantastic graphics, realistic, photorealistic, shooting Call of Duty or cars or whatever, you know, racing games, and everything looks real. I'm actually quite open to the idea of, like, you know, pixel art graphics and 8 colours and a fun little shooter. So you are getting indie games that, like, really just go back to, like, looking like 8-bit games and 16-bit games and can be done on a small budget, because people are realising, actually, playability is key.
Yeah.
Again.
And you're absolutely right. And what I really love about what I'm seeing in the indie game scene is they're taking that old ethic, but they're putting in these really unique game mechanics which you didn't get back in the old days, be it because you've got a touchscreen on hand or you've got an analog controller. But there's just these wonderful little game mechanics which is bringing it into the modern age while still feeling retro. Because I genuinely believe, for me anyway, that they're not going to be as valued, the games now, but we're seeing almost a resurgence of that golden era of gaming in terms of the indie game scene. You look on, I think Steam has got its indie game era, hasn't it, as well, on the PC. I don't really follow Steam, but it's allowing people to get their stuff out there again. And I think it's a really golden era again now for that type of game.
Yeah, I think it's, well, I'd say one of the things that's given PS4 such a foothold in the market and taken, you know, it's pretty much battered the Xbox One. It's the indie scene. It's the indie scene, and it's what you're talking about. It's like the PS4 opened their arms up and welcomed the indie developers back in, and they made a real show of it. When the PS4 came out and they had their launch sort of a conference, they really made a big, massive show of, like, we've got indie developers. You are welcome with open arms. And like you said about Sahid, it was him bringing it in. You know what I mean? It's so fair play to him, because this is what he started, and it's fantastic. You know what I mean? He's like, this is where it began. He's like welcoming these indie developers back in, and we have got like a golden era now. We have got like such cool, interesting, funky little titles on the PS4. I see them day in, day out in work, and it's like, and I see the AAAs as well. And sometimes for me, it's like the indie games are where it's at. Yeah. I'm like, I walk around and I see, like, you know, someone's machine, they've got like incredible graphics on the latest AAA, obviously I can't mention names, but AAA game. And I was like, oh yeah, okay, I heard about that coming out. Yeah, it looks pretty good. Yeah, yeah. And then I walk past someone else who's just engrossed, headphones on, blasting away at this like little twin stick, 8-bit looking shooter.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is that any good? And they're like, oh, I love it. I love it. And I'm like, I'm going to have to give me a go.
Yeah, I think it's capturing people's imagination again, isn't it? Because actually, the imagination's a key part of it, because it's not photorealistic graphics and all that sort of stuff. You have to use your imagination again. So yeah. It almost draws you in, like in the old days, where you had to make up the rest of the visual sort of scape that you're in, so it made it look more real. You know, we thought graphics on the Commodore or Spectrum or Amstrad were fantastic at the time. Because our brain did the rest.
Yeah, and that's what we didn't know anything else. You know what I mean? This was the first time. And they were brilliant because it was the first time you'd seen them. And it was the first time you'd had them in your own house or in your own bedroom as well. So it was a case of like, this is amazing. And it was amazing. It's easy to look back out and go, oh God, that looks shit. Look at the state of it. It's like 8 colours. Look, and you laugh. Mm. But it's like, hang on a minute. You just wind it to the point when it never existed.
Yeah.
And then you got that in your house. It was fantastic. It was amazing. It was thrilling. You had music, you had sound, you had graphics, you had colour, and you were controlling it yourself in your house. It was amazing. You know what I mean? And it's like, so we've been very lucky to like witness the whole evolution. But I do think we've come to a point where people are like a bit fed up now of like AAA and another Call of Duty or another FIFA or another golf game or another rating. It's the same, the same, the same. And I'm putting this out to people myself because I'm not a fan of like first-person shooters and stuff. It's like, it might look nice and sparkly, but once again, you are walking around with a gun shooting people, and that's what's going on.
Yeah.
You're doing the same thing with a different coat of paint.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Where's the originality? Where's the creativity? And it is when you get back to those indie games and even the ones with the retro graphics, and it's like, this is fun. This is really fun. It's like, I'm properly like, involved in the game. It's fast. It's frenetic. And like you said, sometimes they add in a different factor into the control method or something that you didn't get back in the 8-bit days and the 16-bit days, but even though it looks the same, maybe it's just twin sticks.
Yeah.
The shooter, you just got the second stick for like aiming and one for moving, and it's like, it's cool, man. It's really cool. I love it.
Yeah, so I think you can get creative on those platforms now. Something like Yo-Yo Games Maker, there's a load of indie games coming out that's developed in that, and that's by Mike Daly, who did Lemmings on the Amiga and other platforms. So, you know, you can get creative now and make those old games quite easily. Which is
absolutely fits
perfectly into this podcast. So I think that rounds it up, doesn't it, Steve? I think we've waxed lyrical and had a good little chat about the creative
ways. Did we make sure that we pointed out that the Amiga was the best?
I don't think we did that enough.
I'd just like to point out that the Amiga. No, yeah, I think you're right, mate. I think we've covered most of the angle. You know, obviously there'd be quite a lot that we missed out because people's experiences are what they used.
Of course,
I mean, 8-bit and 16-bit, you know, but to come on the forum and tell us what we didn't talk about, and you know,
absolutely. I mean, there's stuff like people got creative with, you know, operating systems or just doing something like desktop publishing. That to someone is a creative outlet, isn't it? And I remember using fractal generators for. You remember fractals?
I used to think they were amazing.
Yeah, you know, so there were so many different creative outlets. So it'd be great to hear from you to what you did on your old computers and what were your memories around it. You know, I had one memory down here. It wasn't a creative tool. It was something called The Key on Spectrum. And it was just a tape copier. But obviously, I remember copying games on it. And that's just a little memory. And for me, that was quite creative at the time before I could code and such like. So it's kind of relative, isn't it? It's all relative.
Well, that's like Xcopy on the Amiga.
Exactly, yeah. You're spot on.
Yeah, and like I used to think I was a genius to be able to copy Xcopy with Xcopy and give it to my mate. I was like, as if I was letting him into some kind of secret society. It's like, oh yeah, I'll sort you out, mate. I'm not going to copy all these games for you. Here's a copy of Xcopy.
Do it yourself.
Do it yourself.
Teach a man to fish.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I felt like a pirate. I felt like the pirater that I was mentioning before.
Yeah, yeah. Mike, wasn't it? Mike the pirate.
Mike the pirate.
Mike the pirate. Yeah. Currently in jail serving 12 years.
Yes, that's the one. So anyway, yes.
That rounds it up, doesn't it? I think that's give you a good idea of what we liked in our younger days and what was out there and what you might want to go back and look upon in the creative worlds. And maybe you might want to start making stuff again. I'm tempted by shooting up construction kit again. I really am.
Definitely, definitely. But like you say, I mean, these guys, if you guys want to get onto the forums and tell us, you know, not only what did you used to use, but did you make anything?
Tell us.
Yes. Absolutely. So, yes, we round it up.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to confirm the address for the club, Retro Asylum, is club@retroasylum.com. That's where you send your request to become part of the club and send your fan mail for Drisk or hate mail. You know, we welcome both. We welcome both.
Knickers and bras. He wants
knickers and bras and anything else you want to send to the Drisk.
Preferably not soiled. Or maybe soiled, I don't know.
I don't know what his tastes are. But yes, yeah, so it's club@retroasylum.com. Issue 2 of the magazine will be out very shortly, and I'm sure if you ask politely, issue 1 will be sent to your email inbox.
Excellent. Any shout-outs, Matt?
The world.
The world.
The world.
The world.
Everyone involved, everyone who shares the love and retro world, and not the Coleco Chameleon people.
Oh, sod them. They can do one. I'm going to give a couple of shout-outs. All the guys that made all these different programmes that we've just been talking about, because usually, you know, you open the creative doors to us as kids. Quick shout out to the guys on our team, the Drisk, Matt, Paul Davies, Dean. Is there anyone else on our team?
Mads, new host.
New Mads. Oh, yes, sorry. New Mads.
Our new
host, Mads. How do you think he got on his last episode? I thought he did great.
Sounded good, yeah. Nice start, really good start.
The thing is, he makes us international.
Do you know what's embarrassing, Steve, is his English is better than mine.
Oh, yeah, no,
he sounded more eloquent, with more finesse and probably much more grammatical skills than little old English boy me.
I've got no chance, have I, with my Scouse accent? I've had it.
Go out and nick a car now.
But yeah, so welcome to Mads. I thought you did absolutely great. Well done, mate. Shout out to the Retro Hour. Give that a listen. If you like your Amiga stuff especially, those guys are doing great. Hopefully we'll get them on at some point. And shout out to the Retro Game Squad. Listen to them all the time. They're the American podcast. We had one of the hosts on our show a while back. Did really well, but they're always giving us a shout out as well, and I listen to them.
Excellent. Well, I must confess I've never listened or heard of it, so I shall go and check that out now. So
check them out. Really good. Really
lovely
good
stuff. Excellent.
And to all our listeners and everyone, please leave us an iTunes review. Keep listening to the show, and hopefully we'll speak to you soon.
Take care now. See you
take
later.
It easy. Bye bye.
Was a Castaway Media production. Find more great podcasts on our network. Visit castaway.media.